What's happening, blues people? You see, I just want y'all to get a look at this. We're not even waiting for anyone to join us. We're going to start this right now. And as we start this right now, just know whoever misses the energy and the frequency of the live broadcast, you better go and get this archive. I'm sitting with Christina Gatti. What's happening, lady?
I'm doing pretty good.
Okay. Well, look, we'll start like this, right? And as you know, I like to give regional credits. So Baltimore's own Christina Gatti, right? Because I met you in Baltimore.
We did. We met at the, the American Folklore Society Conference.
Yes,
that's 2019.
That's right. 20, yeah. Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I'm not allowed to say that I'm from, if you didn't go to high school in Baltimore, you're not allowed to say that you're from Baltimore. Doesn't matter how long you've lived here.
Really?
High school here. Because if you say you're from Baltimore, the first thing people will ask is, where'd you go to high school? If you don't have an answer for that, then.
Then it's like, you're not from Baltimore.
You're not from Baltimore, so.
Understood. I love the folklore. I love it. Okay, so. Well, can we say residents of folk, yes. of Baltimore?
Resident of Baltimore. They'll give me that much.
Okay, cool. Okay, so before we get into the good stuff, you know, I got to give a couple of announcements. First and foremost, as we celebrate the Kentucky-Tennessee Emancipation, not necessarily Juneteenth, but August 8th, we'll be down in the Black Bottom of Russellville, Kentucky, with a blues festival that my organization partnered with the Sikh Museum, as well as local and national and resident bluesman Michael Goff, the Black Bottom Acoustic Blues and Phil Hollis Festival, honoring Sylvester Weaver. That's August 4th and August 5th, that weekend celebrating the emancipation. It is imperative that you all not only participate, but we are still taking donations and we're still looking for sponsorship, specifically because this year marks the 100th year anniversary of Sylvester Weaver's and Sal Martin's song that is the first vocal and single acoustic guitar accompaniment which makes acoustic blues, country blues, what it is today. All right. And then also, you know, you need to go to Spotify, you need to go to Apple Podcasts, you need to go to iHeart, and you need to smash on that. You need to go to YouTube and subscribe, okay? And now, with all that good stuff out of the way, let's get to what's really important. Miss Christina Gatti and this book, Well of Souls. So I'm going to jump around a bit, right? Because I like it to be, or get, look who's giving us a shout out. What's happening, Miss Jackie? You know, I got love right here for Miss Jackie. She told me not to call her that. I'm sorry. What's happening, Jackie? What's going on? I had a thing. So, Christina, you have this very detailed book. I like how it's set up. But before we get into the book, I really want to know your because I see them in the back as well. You deal with gourds as well as banjos, right? So what spawned this? Where did the inspiration of this instrument and your connection to it come from?
I'm a fiddler more than a banjo player.
Really?
Yeah. So I grew up playing like classical violin and orchestra and all that. And my mom's from Sweden. So I started playing some Swedish folk music with her. But then, you know, my dad's family's from North Carolina and South Carolina on the border to North Carolina. And I have an aunt that plays bluegrass banjo. So I started kind of dabbling in some of that music too, and ended up learning, moving to Elkins, West Virginia, playing a lot of old time music. And like a lot of people, had that kind of preconceived notion that style of music is, you know, from the mountains or from the South. And it wasn't until Pete Ross, who's my partner now, told me about a black fiddler that's from where I actually did grow up, which is in Kensington, Maryland. And so this fiddler's name was William Adams, and he was from Kengar and from Maryland, and played what we would kind of consider, you know, old time music. And that, you know, even though I had seen like Carolina Chocolate Drops by that point, and I knew about, you know, black contributions to the music, it had never really struck me like, oh, here's this guy who's from less than a mile where I grew up, who was playing this music, was a fiddler, and kind of started me in on what's, you know, more of that research angle. But I will say I never thought I was going to write a book on the banjo. I thought I was just going to do research and hang out with people who did research and like not even do it as a hobby, but share information with like a very select group of people. And what started happening was, is I recounted at the very beginning of the book, is Pete and I are in a museum in Amsterdam, which is where one of the oldest banjos is today. And we come across these dioramas, and it was like, whoa, I think there's something here that can tell us more about the banjo's early history, which while there was like a general consensus of, you know, invented by people of African descent in the Americas, you know, these kind of Caribbean origins, we had like those broad outlines, but there still seemed to be so much missing. And I just couldn't help digging in and researching and trying to figure out these missing parts. And that then like literally put me down a rabbit hole of research. Also to the point where I was just totally obsessed. But again, I didn't think it was going to be a book. I thought it was going to be like presenting at places like AFS and, you know, presenting at places like Banjo Gathering. And that would be it. And sharing it with those people. But as I got further and further into it, I realized this history was really important, and it is so important that it couldn't just be disseminated in that small, you know, group, that it really needed to be something that was accessible to, you know, basically everybody who wants to learn about it.
Right. So there's so much to unpack in that initial statement, right? And I love it because that's what this is about. I like how you said you just thought it would be something you'll be presenting at the American Folklore Society. So big ups to them, right?
yeah.
But before we go into the a multi-layered statement of where it's traveled and how you actually were inspired to take on this lofty, right? This work has a lot of girth.
Yeah, I don't know if it's lofty so much as it was crazy of just like, oh God, you're doing this? Okay.
You're right. but one thing I did notice, which is why, well, I don't really want to set it up for you. I don't want to spoon feed it, but both sides of your family have a specific connection to a specific traditional instrument. And it's just kind of ironic how these things play out in your life. Care to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. It's also really interesting because neither of my parents grew up playing any music at all. Wow. That wasn't in their like immediate kind of background. They both came to it in their like early 20s. They met each other and they started playing music together. So them coming into, you know, these genres of music was, and it's the same thing with my aunt too, who plays banjo. She she grew up in, she's my uncle's wife, grew up in North Wilkesboro, which is, you know, like up in the North Carolina mountains, like very, you know, very bluegrass area. And she also started playing banjo when she was an adult because she was drawn to it. But I think it's a kind of that cultural memory and that idea that you do have some like music in the background that drew all of those family members into it. And then were, you know, kind of providing it to, you know, in my case with my parents, providing it to me and my brothers, of saying that music is really important. And, you know, at first very much focusing on classical music, but then allowing that space to, you know, explore like what that traditional, always air quotes around traditional, but what those traditional forms of music were, where it was coming from, and exploring that further, which has been really, really interesting and really cool on lots of sides, even just getting into Swedish music in the very beginning, and realizing, and again, it's one of those things like realizing how little you can sometimes know about something that should seem so familiar, where you think like, oh, we're always surrounded by traditional music, but like how much do we actually know about it and where it's come from?
Right. And I think that's where that air quote comes in when we say traditional music. And what I appreciate is you speak like a folklorist and an ethnomusicologist. So is there any of this in your background, either or sometimes they're hybrid?
I studied history and languages as an undergraduate. And so I take everything from a very, you know, historiography kind of history background, that kind of approach. But one of the things that I think history for a long time has had a problem with is not interrogating enough where sources come from, who the people are that are doing the recording. And there's like, obviously that problem exists in ethnomusicology and folklore and like basically anything where we're studying people, we got to think about people. But I did start getting that experience in the ethnomusicology-ish field when I was living in Elkins. I was in AmeriCorps and I was working with the Augusta Heritage Center on some folk work, some field recordings to put those together into a compilation. And so, you know, even from that period, it was kind of having those conversations about who gets recorded, who doesn't get recorded, why songs, why these people, why this place. And so I joked in a conversation last weekend about I never have a straight answer for anything. I always just have more questions. But I think that's like, that's the nature of a lot of this work where it's like, if you just have answers, like that's not great. Like it's no. Like, question that you can ask people.
Right. You sound like a folklorist and I welcome you into our field, right? Because these are some of the conversations. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Christina Gaddy about her book, Well of Souls, Uncovering the Banjo's Hidden History, along with her journey, which coincides with the book more than some believe. And we're going to get to not just the book, but what could be considered, I don't want to say controversy because that's not the truth. That's salacious and kind of polarizing, right? But if there's any pushback, right? And we'll get to that. But I do like where we're at in talking about these field recordings and deciding who gets to record and things of that nature. You know, I actually, that's where I met Jackie at the Augusta.
Yeah.
That's where I met Jackie. So you work with them. Could talk about that experience and the significance of that experience for you and the significance of that experience for musicians who appreciate and play traditional music.
Yeah, so Augusta has a really great archive, and I was working with Jerry Milnes, who at the time. I think his title was folklorist, but I'm not sure. He's since retired, but is still very much active in old time and traditional music, especially within West Virginia. And again, I got kind of obsessed with the ideas of, you know, the very regional style of fiddle and banjo music that comes from, you know, not even just West Virginia, but like those kind of counties, Randolph County, West Virginia, and those fiddlers and those banjo players. And so it was really interesting to be able to do a deep dive. And I was doing it with a musician named Currence Hammonds, who's a relative of the more famous West Virginia Hammonds family for the old time people that are out there listening. But what was interesting was we were putting together the liner notes for these recordings. And one of, you know, my jobs in working on this was writing down where these tunes were coming from and, you know, their relationship to Currence as he was playing them. And, you know, that was just an interesting thing where you both had tunes that were being played where they were like common, well-known tunes, and ones that were very regionally specific, that basically was like Currence is the only person who plays them. And I think, you know, that also then opened up something that exists for me within old time music, especially that I've been thinking about a lot lately, which is, you know, the prevalence of tunes that stem from blackface minstrelsy within the old time repertoire. And that, you know, people would just play these tunes without having any conceptualization of that's where they stem from, this very, you know, number one, they think, oh, they must be so much older. And it's like, no, these are only from the 1850s. Right. Number two, they're, you know, from this extremely racist art form. And, you know, I think people are grappling with that more now in the last, like, you know, 3 to 4 years than they were when I was living in Elkins, which was in 2009 to 2011. So a while back. But it's also just an interesting way to look at how some of this music has both those like regional variations and people playing their own styles and playing their own music and, you know, have learned from different traditions even, and then very specifically how there are tunes that come from, you know, what was in essence a commercial music form that got, you know, printed on sheet music and sent out all across the country. But so those were some interesting kind of learning moments that I had while working on that, while being like surrounded by a very specific vernacular tradition in West Virginia.
You know, and the irony, shameless plug, African American Folklorist magazine, and we have a section called Emerging Folklorists and younger people that write for this and older adults who believe they're amateur in the field, right? I bring that up because my daughter actually wrote a article about these songs that are everyday, mm-hmm. that come from this era and people sing it. It's the ice cream truck plays it and people do not know the origins and what the words really meant. So you bring that up and that's very telling. So now we're going to like I said, we're going to jump around a bit because I want to go from there to you getting to deep diving into this research, because it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, which you will as you take over when I hand it to you, there were different significant moments that were kind of like bing, bing, and each bing led you deeper and deeper into this rabbit hole.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, that's exactly it. So the first moment was being in that museum in Amsterdam and seeing, so there's this a series of dioramas and they're really interesting and significant because the man who made them was actually Afro-Surinamese. So he was of European and African descent. And so he has an interesting place in the culture of Suriname, which is a Caribbean country on the north coast of South America. And, you know, because he's definitely not considered white, even though he's free and his, you know, father is white, his grandfather is white, is like some, you know, it's like going back generations. But his mom is of African descent, so he's considered of African descent. But he still has more knowledge and more insight into the culture of Suriname, the Afro-Surinamese culture, because of that lineage and heritage. So he does these, and this is also to say he's also a great artist, and he does these dioramas with really amazing veracity. You know, they're like as wide as, you know, basically as wide as a dining room table, but they're not very deep. He makes a perspective so they look like it's a big scene going back, but they're only probably like that wide. And just amazing detail with instruments, with people's outfits and props and jewelry that the women are wearing. And, you know, the aha moment with that was not only that this piece of art existed that looks almost identical to an image from South Carolina from the 1790s, which was painted by a man named John Rose of enslaved people dancing with a banjo and a drum. And so this diorama is like almost identical to that one in terms of the visual imagery. And, you know, and then the other kind of crazy moment is that diorama is depicting something that's called a banya play. And banya is one of the early words for banjo. So again, it's like, okay, what's going on here? Why does this have the same name as the instrument? And then the most amazing thing is that it's still, you know, talk about folklore, it's still a living tradition in Suriname today. So there are ethno-danceologists, I don't know what they're called, people who study dance, and people who study art and people who study music who've been able to like trace this tradition as far back, you know, even farther back than the dioramas, which are from the early 1800s, all the way through, you know, post the end of slavery in Suriname, which happens in 1865, and through, you know, the contemporary scene that exists today and the people that are working, you know, to revive it, but also, traditions change, they evolve. And so what that looks like today, but that just became this amazing opportunity to investigate that dance and what, you know, its ritual, spiritual significance was, what the purpose of the dance was, and kind of to try to take that and figure out, well, what can we learn about something like the South Carolina watercolor? And what can we learn about other accounts of the banjo, knowing how important the banjo was to these dances in Suriname, and kind of trying to build that all together. So that was like this impetus, this moment of being like, okay, I gotta figure this out. I have to do all the archival research. I have to try to put this puzzle together. And there were lots of moments, not quite as big as that one along the way, but little ones where I'd see the same thing appear in New Orleans as I had in Suriname, or I'd see the same thing appear in New York as in South Carolina, and the same words being used for instruments, the same, you know, dances being described, the same songs being sung, all these kinds of things, and having that moment of all of this is more connected than we've kind of given it credit for, that we've assumed that it has been. And, you know, so we end up talking about traditions that our first image of a banjo is 1687 in Jamaica. And that banjo basically seems to be, because the original one is lost, but seems to be constructed the same way as the one that's on the cover of the book, which was collected 150 years later in Haiti. You know, so the idea that these traditions can continue, but also evolve over time, but continue over that span of time is also, I think, you know, one of the shocking things we think about the destruction of slavery and how many people were worked to death and, you know, died because of the awful conditions of slavery. And yet we can have music and culture and tradition that span those generations. And that was also, you know, a profoundly powerful thing to be thinking about while doing the research.
Well, so again, if you're just tuning in, I'm speaking to Christina Gaddy about her book, Well of Souls, Uncovering the Banjo's Hidden History, as she encapsulates this, or summarizes, if you will, what happened to her in this, how can we say, rabbit hole, if you will, but she does it eloquently. So I guess at this point, my question would be, the name of the book, what, why Well of Souls?
So I had originally heard that idea of the banjo, the gourd. So I'll also just, you know, say it's like the gourd, there's a gourd banjo on the cover of the book, but, you know, just for the up close, gourd body, four strings, short, long. But I'd heard Pete's mentor, Scott Didlake, say that he felt that the banjo was in itself a well of souls. And he meant it in, I think, a pretty metaphorical way, thinking about, talking about that destruction, talking about all the lives lost, of thinking of all of the people whose lives intersected with the banjo, and yet we don't know anything about them today. I tried to name as many people as I could that appear in historic accounts in Well of Souls, to try to say, like, these are the people that we know, these are the names that we know. But for example, the banjo that's on the cover, we don't know the name of the man who made it, the name of the man who played it. So that was kind of Scott's conceptualization of it, that, you know, it's a repository for all of these memories and for all of this experience. But it was one of those things where, you know, Scott was Pete's mentor, was a very intuitive person. And he didn't mean it Well of Souls in a literal sense. But as I started doing this research, that's what I realized that the banjo was, in fact. And I get into it in some very, you know, a lot of detail in the book, and that's kind of where it builds to. But the idea as the banjo itself as being a vessel that would hold spirits, that would hold ancestors. We see this concept in Vodou drums today as one of the kind of, like, you know, best examples, where a drum can not only conjure spirits and bring them into a ritual space, but can in fact, like, hold them there. You have jugs that will hold spirits, and even people can hold spirits. And as I was doing this research, I was like, oh my gosh, the banjo is the same as the drums, right? That it was banjo and drum. Those were the two instruments, and that the banjo itself served that same purpose as an instrument, not just, you know, like a musical thing that we play, but in itself a ritual device that could, yeah, hold spirit. So it's I'm still here.
What happened?
I don't know. Am I still here?
Yeah, I see you.
Okay, sorry. My computer decided to freak out for a second. I guess that's what happens when we're live.
Well, yeah, when we're live and we're talking about objects that hold souls.
Yeah. Oh, there we go. Now I'm here.
Yeah. So, you know, that, you know, it's amazing because, again, we're speaking the representation, or not even just the representation of something, but how a material item, if you will, an instrument, is representation in a culture, in its traditional belief, in its folk and spiritual belief, and how it actually materializes, how it plays a physical part, right, in the space, but yeah. then it plays a part that is tangible, but not necessarily physical, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it, you know, it's, it again, it was like a very technical thing. I actually have a, so this banjo is made more playable, but this little banjo, little guy that I have, that Dina Ross Jennings made and graciously gave to me.
Hi, thing, Mama Dina. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. So it's constructed a little bit more like the historic banjos, where, you know, this neck, you know, enters and exits through the center of the gourd. And that's, in fact, exactly also how these ritual rattles are constructed in Suriname and in Haiti, and coming from African tradition. And so it was like these objects that we have that can tell us about history. And we, Pete and I have been talking to some, a European music collection that may or may not have, another early banjo. And in our conversation with them about, viewing it and examining it, the curator just said, like, I just want to make sure you're not going to, you know, mess it up at all when you're here, like that you're not going to take any samples of anything or, you know, whatever. And I'm laughing because I was just like, no, like, absolutely not. And one of the things that I don't think I had like articulated super well until I started thinking about that ask from him was that the four early gourd banjos that we have, and there's only four, even though there were more and they were lost over time, in these European musical instrument collections, and some of them have been rediscovered, but that of these four, that those are the only objects that we have that are made by the people who played them themselves. You know, the enslaved people who, and even, you know, in the case of the, you know, later post-revolution Haiti, the free people of African descent who would have played banjos, we just don't, as of right now, don't have any records of those people saying, this is the instrument that I made, this is why I made it this way, this is, you know, the material that I chose, this is how many strings it has, this is the tuning that I chose. We have none of that, you know, sourced from those people. And so then the objects themselves, that tangible object, becomes invaluable, because then it's about, well, what did they choose? What did they, you know, of the material that's left, why did they choose to make it like this? Why did they choose that gourd? Why did they choose, you know, to put those decorations on it, and try to figure out as much as we can about it? And that's also that idea of like messing the instruments up in any way, you would be losing things that, you know, and maybe it's something that everybody who's seen that instrument who's alive today, you know, wouldn't be able to figure out. But in 3 years, somebody new could go see that instrument and say, I have a theory, or I have, and, you know, some sort of connection to it that we haven't been able to see yet. And if we mess it up, then, you know, that's not gonna be
right. We don't want to do that, you know. And, you know, so we also have to, well, let me reword that, and make it more of a question, because we don't know. We're asking, you're the expert, right? No, I'm serious. So being a spiritual instrument as well, right? Similar to Indigenous of Americas, we have on the sacred material items that are not to be moved, utilized for purposes, right? Have you found in your studies that banjos or some were in fact similar to where they, not only did they hold souls, right, but they were the sacred material items, instruments that if moved, if touched the wrong way, could it put a curse on you? Should you not touch it? Should you return it back? Where did you get any of this information?
Yeah, I mean, I think the one that's the most that was the other big aha moment for me was I had kind of been like floating around with this idea that the banjo was a spiritual instrument itself, and that these dances and you know, things that people had just assumed were secular dances for fun were in fact, you know, religious rituals.
And intentional,
right. And so I had been playing around with that, and the thing that really solidifies it, and it kind of comes as a, you know, high point in the action of the book, is the account of another banjo that's from Suriname, where the person who collected it was a white German missionary, a religious man. And he takes that banjo because it is a spiritual object in a religion that is not Christianity, that is interrupting people's ability to be Christians. So if you have, you know, a banjo and that's a religious object for this other religion, well then, you know, your ability to come to Jesus Christ and you know, enter the Moravian religion is going to be impaired. So I need to get rid of that. And he takes the banjo.
Wow.
And he documents that he takes other pots and idols, other religious objects, and just those ones he straight up destroys, throws them in a river, smashes them, you know, is destructive of this. But the banjo, for whatever reason, he didn't leave a, you know, clear record of why he saved it, but the banjo he keeps and ends up donating to a museum, and which is now a museum that's in Berlin, Germany. But that idea that the banjo held so much power that he had to confiscate it was just really, really powerful and really key to being like, okay, yes, this idea that the banjo could, you know, put a curse on you or could be used in a ritual that would bring, I mean, you know, we see this a bunch of times over the course of the history of enslavement, which is that white people get very freaked out, as they, you know, should have been, about revolts and uprisings.
Right.
And we have numerous occasions where music and dance are the kind of instigating moment where people are coming together, they're able to communicate. But not only that, when we have music and dance, we also have to assume that the spirituality is there and that they're calling on, you know, higher powers to help them in this attempt at freedom. And so we also see the occasions of, there's another account of a banjo being destroyed by a white slave owner. Also for sit, like he's not on the religious side of it as much as the missionary was, but he's on the side of, this is dangerous behavior. I do not want the banjo being around because it could kind of foment dissent. It would be part of, that was in Jamaica, so it would be part of Obeya. And, you know, the white folks were afraid that these religions could also harm them. That people did have spiritual powers that could, that could harm them.
Well, you know, I love it. I love it. I love it. I just love it. I want to ask you a couple of questions, but before I ask you that, I have to ask you this because it's just like right here. I really like, and I'm picking up the book for those who can't see, how you put the book together in regards to movements, and the movements would be the chapters, and then the locations, the spaces, the regions, right, along with the dates. So we got this like trajectory, if you will, a linear movement, right? Easy to follow for, it's because one of the major functions of my organization is taking this academic jargon and making it layperson, and so someone like myself you know, who's not the smartest person in the room, I could follow this very easily, right? What was the catalyst? What was your vision in doing it that way?
It took me a long time to figure that out. I, like I said, I didn't think I was going to write a book on the banjo. And basically, once I started to get all this stuff that I've been kind of spewing here, like, you know, just having that all in a landscape, I knew that I had to put it into a format that would be easy for people to read and digest. And I think, like I said at the top, like I really believed that this was not, you know, academics do amazing work. I am forever grateful to them for what they do and, you know, the deep dives that they do into subjects that are like so, so, so narrow. And I love them for that. But a lot of times that material that they put out isn't easily digestible by an audience. And like, sometimes that's just because they're so into it that they just like want to have all of the information. And sometimes it's because they feel forced to use the academic jargon and to say, to like, basically like, I know these words, I deserve to be here. I'm going to use, you know, like the big words and the complex ideas. And I, you know, again, like I respect all of that, but I knew that if I was going to write a book about the banjo and like, it was two things. It was one, I wanted this to be a book that anybody could pick up and read, that you didn't have to be an academic. You didn't have to have any prior knowledge of the banjo. You didn't have to have any prior knowledge of, you know, some of the historical things that are happening at the same time. Cause I'm also, you know, I've just, having done historical research, I just see so much of the time how historical archives are closed off to people and that you have to have a lot of privilege to be able to access them, whether that's like they're only open on weekdays. So if you have a job, you can't go see them. The material is somewhere where you don't live. So if you want to go there, you got to pay for it yourself. And that's like not even getting into like the politics of the materials that you're getting into, like just that access. So, you know, part of what I like am just, and I've been doing some other things too to try to like figure out how I can get the information out there so that if other people want to like look at the same research that I looked at and do something else with it, like, you know, by all means, like, please go dive deeper, somebody, you know, take it and run. But the other thing was, is, you know, I'm a historian, but then I got my MFA in writing really because I thought I was going to work in museums and archives in that like public facing way of being like, here's history. I want to share it with people.
I told you you were a folklorist, but go ahead.
Yeah, I guess it is. Like, where's museum studies and folklore? Like, where's that overlap? But yeah, it was like, it's about like sharing it with the people. And I also then had that realization of like that so much of this history is just not accessible to people. And so I, you know, I went to graduate school for writing very much in the, like, I want to figure out how to write history in a compelling way so that people want to read it. And so approaching this book, that was really difficult because there is no main character. There's no, like, we're only in this place, but over time, or we're only talking about this one instrument over time, or we're talking about this one person over time. There's no like central thing that keeps it going other than the question of what the heck is an early banjo and what, you know, what was it used for? And so I ended up figuring out like how to bring those, basically how to make it readable. And this is also like, it takes a long time to answer every question, but the real answer is I was like, okay, significant banjo accounts, let's focus on those over time. And so that each section, each chapter has, you know, a banjo account, which is, you know, a person that made that account. Who is that person? Why did they make it? What's their deal? Where are we? You know, what's important to know? But then also in that, how much can I share about the life, you know, a lot of, you know, almost all of the examples in the book of the people making the accounts are white European men. And there's always more to find out about them than women, than people of color, like, you know, enslaved people, right? But how much can we figure out about the banjo player, the person who would have been dancing or playing this music or singing this song? And so to kind of combine those two with the banjo account and just move through these accounts like that. And again, like it's definitely not every early banjo account. It's not even probably every significant early banjo account. I really had to choose which are the ones that I can tell a good story, which are the ones that can like fully explore this person, and which ones are the ones that kind of serve this story that I'm trying to tell about the spirituality of the instrument as well.
Well, first, I want to say that...
I get your question in the end?
You did. I mean, it's ironic that you asked me that, because you said that I give these long, drawn-out answers. No, you're giving us the details that myself and my audience look for. This is what we come here for. This is the juice, the good juice, right?
Good, good.
Not the expose, but what really matters.
Good.
You know, so now we can get to the slightly uncomfortable stuff, because, you know, when you think of, and just in your earlier statement, your first statement, we speak about menstruacy, right? And mm-hmm. then in your last statement, you speak about most of these accounts come from white males. So I guess it's safe to say that anytime we speak about culture, but particularly the banjo, there's an extreme racial component to this instrument that kind of crosses continents, oh, right? Yeah. So here are two questions that are kind of like, they're not separate, but they're separate.
Okay.
On the one hand, right? On the one hand, those who have a decent understanding or believe they have a decent understanding of banjos only equate it to white bluegrass musicians.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have a white scholar writing about something and finds out all this other stuff, you know, that obviously is troubling just based on your verbiage, right? Troubling based on how the people were treated who were using these, not all, but some, right? So how did that feel? And then you can follow up with, was there any pushback from white or black or anyone in between based on you taking on such a monumental feat? I mean, this is not, we're not talking about something that goes back to the 1400s in one location, right? And when I say one location, like one continent, one state, you kind of had to go globally for this,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. So this is a big undertaking, Christina. Come on. So those are two questions. The pushback and this realization that, wow, we all believe it was this, but like you said, there's this other story. You know, how did that feel for you?
Yeah. So, and one of the things that I struggled with from the beginning, and also again on that, like, am I even going to write a book about this, was I am a white person. I am a white lady. Like I said, my mom's from Sweden. My dad's family has lived, you know, on what was once Cherokee land since the, you know, early 1700s. There are people in his family who were enslavers and owned other humans. Like that was all history that I knew, because you're not from North Carolina and that's not part of your family story. And if it is, you are lying to yourself.
Wow.
So having that background, I, you know, was very much continually questioning, like, well, you know, should I be telling this story? Because, and I've said this before to other folks, it's just like, I know that there's things like even in descriptions of if it's a white person who's made an account from, like, let's say 1720, and they transcribed a song or they wrote down some lyrics, like I know, or made a piece of art, I know there's going to be things that I, with my background, won't see and won't make a connection to basically an ongoing, you know, African-American tradition that would exist today. And I knew that from the beginning. And I thought, like, is this even, you know, my place to be telling a story that was, in essence, you know, this is, you know, up until the very end of the book, this is really a lot about, you know, African-American Black history. But the other thing is that white people effed it up. We're not going to say the word because we're on platforms. But white people messed it up really badly. And not even just at the time making these accounts that were often derogatory, but into the late 19th and 20th century of denying this history and manipulating it. And again, like that doesn't even have anything to do, you know, with minstrelsy itself, but like even post-dating that, you know, coming up with lies about, you know, that Black people didn't play the banjo, or people starting to say like the banjo, it comes from Ireland, right? And these really terrible things that were erasing a history. And so I was also like, well, I don't think it's right to sit around and say, well, it's only like white people mess this, you know, if we had an attitude that was white people mess this thing up for other people, and those other people, you know, Black people need to go fix it, like we would never get anywhere as a society. That's not the tack that we need to take with anything. And it shouldn't be the tack that we should take with history either. So that's kind of where I finally came around to. And again, with that like public access of, I can get this out there because I do have the privilege of being able to go to this archive, to read this language that this document is in. And I can bring it, and I can also put it places on the internet where people don't even have to, you know, have the book, but can be like, I want to go read that source that she has. I want to go look at this thing myself. I want to go look at that image. I want to go listen to that song. And that access to people so that they can then use it for, you know, whatever, not bad purposes, but whatever good purposes they want to use that for, whatever research they want to do. And there, like you said, like there's just so many misconceptions about the banjo that my feeling was like, if I can't get this out there, then we can't start the process of other people coming in and, you know, doing more research and doing just the work to unpack all of this. And I mean, you know, coming back to minstrelsy, I had also not wanted to include that in the book because it's so complicated and so ugly, and just difficult to write about, difficult to research. But again, it's really important to understanding like how American culture has developed, because that's kind of this genesis point of Americans exporting their music, Americans stealing Black music, all starts right there. And you know, and so I'm like, I hope that somebody else, and not just with that part, but I hope that other people read some part of the book and are like, I want to do a deep dive into this one thing, or I want to go do more research on that. And that we slowly start to get a bit bigger and bigger picture. Like I've said, this is not the end all be all of banjo history. It's not the end all be all of early banjo history. It's something that I hope becomes a building block for, you know, other people in the future to do more work with. So, go ahead.
That was great, you know, and informative, and I received it. I hope everyone else received it. Now, just to be fair, I'm going to repeat the second part of that question, because I know it was hard to give, you know, not hard, but you know, you want to answer organically. You don't want to be thinking about what was the second part of that question. and you know what? Even better now that you did answer it, because you give me a more specific piece to the question, right? On both sides of the fence, right? Black folk, whether they identify with Africa or whatever, it travels so much. Wherever they identify with, it's a connection. And then we have white folk who are Irish, right? You said, so are you getting any pushback from these groups that are like, no, this comes from my culture?
It's easy to say on one side. I mean, I will say, like, people have been very receptive in person and people have been very respectful. And I was afraid of, like, I just, to be honest, like, older white men shouting me down. And that has happened in other scenarios, not with this book, but in other scenarios, talking about my research, I've had older white men yelling at me.
Really?
And so, you know, I was like, I was kind of mentally preparing myself for, like, I might find those people along the way. Like, you're going out in public, there, this is public events, there might be somebody who comes and says, what are you talking about that the banjo is black? Like, that's not the truth. Here's the truth. And then they're going to say something that's, you know, not true. And that hasn't happened, really, thankfully, because my constitution I can't handle that. But, you know, on the internet, people are much more willing, when they're kind of pseudo anonymous,
right,
to say things. And so one of the and it's actually like a review that I like, even though it's a bad review on Amazon, where somebody complains that the book is, like, too much about slavery and not about the banjo. And I'm like, well, the banjo doesn't exist without slavery. Like, we cannot, we don't have this instrument without the forced enslavement of people of African descent in the Americas, like, full stop. So if you want to learn about this, if you want to learn about the instrument at all, you have to accept that you're going to have to learn and talk about slavery. Right. And that's uncomfortable. And that's, you know, whatever, you can have these emotions about it, but you cannot deny that. And so when somebody says, like, this book is too much about slavery, it's like, well, cool, then I just made you learn more about, like, the most important part of U.S. history that there is. Because again, we wouldn't have a country without it. And so you have to learn this too. So it's definitely negative, right? It's a negative review. They're complaining about it, but I'm like, I'll wear that as, like, a little badge of honor that you got upset that somebody was trying to tell you real history. So that's that side of it. And I'm sure that there's other people out there who have, you know, specific notions about banjo history and don't want those questioned. And they're probably not even going to read the book. You know, they're just going to be right, like, I don't want to deal with that. I don't want to hear that. I want to, you know, think of the banjo as this, like, white Appalachian instrument and leave it at that. I think the thing that can be hard, on the side of Black Americans reading the book is having this idea of, like, the banjo, you know, one of the things I say really early on in the book is that the banjo is not from Africa. And that, like, I know people could go, like, whoa, what are you talking about, lady? Like, are you trying to say that it's white? Like, what's going on? But my point in saying that is that it has become, like, a really reductive statement of just saying, like, number one, there's a lot of white people who say that because that's their, like, get out of jail free card. If they just say, like, the banjo, it's from Africa. Cool. I don't need to learn anything more about the contributions of, you know, Black Americans to American vernacular music. I'm good. But the other thing is that I am like, we need more nuance than that, because the banjo as it appears in its earliest form does not appear anywhere in Africa, in any community, in any ethnic group, in any culture group. It is a new instrument. And so I don't have a problem with the banjo is African, rather than from Africa, as a linguistic thing. Because it's like, yeah, it's African. Like, it wouldn't exist without people from different, you know, groups in Africa being forced together in forced labor camps and being forced to learn new languages, you know, make new foods, make new religions, because they couldn't continue their lives on as they had been, and they couldn't have the same instruments, and they couldn't have the same exact music or the same exact language. Like, that just doesn't work in the new context. But I haven't gotten, there's no negative reviews of that on Amazon yet.
That's good. That's good. And again, if you're tuning in, I'm speaking with Christina Gatti, author of Well of Souls, Uncovering the Banjo's Hidden History, and we're having a great conversation about the journey to the book, journey with the book, and now we're talking about the responses of the book. And I don't want to keep you too long. However, I do have to, because you are a writer, and this is not the only thing that you write, right? And you made it kind of clear that these tenured white males, well, I don't want to put it, let me not be so polarizing with it, right, and salacious, but you did say you've had an experience or two, right? Let me not get WWE with this, right? Now, if you don't want to share on air, I get it. But if you don't mind, because, you know, that's one of the reasons why I began to take an academic approach, just to give you context of why I'm asking, and also to make you comfortable so you know I'm not putting you on the spot. And anyone else who are listening, you, those of you that's been rocking with me for a while, you already know this. You know, I was tired of tenured and academic, usually white males, questioning my validity, right? From a firsthand experience in my home, in my grandparents' home, et cetera, et cetera. And they had sixth and seventh, and not all of them. The ones who were active participants, the white males that were active participants in Black culture in whatever degree, I didn't have this issue with some of them, right? But majority of them seem to, one, want a jockey who is best to tell a Black story, two, want to question Black people or anybody telling a story that's not them. And it, you know, we can go down the line. I'm not trying to be disparaging to white men, but this is just a fact in this moment with this subject. So I was like, let me get a little bit more academic so that I can have a platform, and the platform could be taken serious, so I can put it in a proper context, you know, and then hopefully facilitate other voices of color or marginalization that they can speak, right? So I say that so you understand I'm not just putting you on the spot, right?
Yeah.
So now, a white man yelled at you about your work that they didn't agree with. Do you mind sharing that story?
Yeah, and I won't get into like too many, you know, specifics of
course
why, who and what, you know. Gossip hour. No, I'm just kidding. But it is, you know, it's always a fascinating thing to me, because especially, and it was banjo related, I will say that. It was about banjo in Appalachia. And it's something that is so tied up with people's identities. And to like go on a brief tangent, a friend of mine, who's a radio producer, and I did a radio piece on a Confederate statue in Baltimore before they had been taken down. And we were interviewing, you know, some experts, and like, it always came back to that idea of like, people have such strong ideas of who they are and what their background is and where they've come from, that as soon as you start to challenge, not like, you're not challenging them, you're just saying, you've been told something, or you believe something that we don't have, like, we don't have the proof for that. We don't have the evidence for that. And when they experience that, they experience a lot of anger and upset, because they do think that you're coming like at them. And to me, that's really mainly been the thing with Banjo, is that when you tell them something that contradicts the narrative they've been telling themselves, they believe that you are like attacking them and who they are. And it's like, no, I'm just showing you the evidence of what we have. It just becomes really hard for them to deal with. And the like augmented problem of that is when they see that you're a woman, that you're a person of color, that you don't have the letters behind your name, whatever it is that makes them, you know, feel superior to you, is that they're going to use that. And then, so instead of saying like, hey, Christina, like your research, you know, is, have you thought about this? Or like, let me tell you something that I found that kind of contradicts what you found, you know, instead of taking that tack to it, they say, you're not from this region. You're not, you know, you didn't grow up playing the banjo. You're not from Appalachia. You didn't, you know, you don't know this, or, I mean, whatever, just like, you're a woman, you know, you're a woman and you're a feminist and that's a problem. And it's like, I mean, the internet, it's a nasty place. You're like, okay, I don't know how to respond to that, because, you know, I recently, there's a lot that got cut from the book. But one of the things I got asked a lot on when I was out doing book events was this very specific thing of like, but when does the banjo show up in Appalachia? When does the banjo show up in Appalachia? And basically, I had an answer to it, but it wasn't like this great, like, here's all of the evidence. So on my website, on my blog, I put up like, here is a bunch of, you know, evidence. And, you know, before the rise of blackface minstrelsy, the banjo was a black instrument. And so the people, like, you would have to have people of African descent in Appalachia. They're the ones who would have brought the banjo there. Like, you know, before minstrelsy, like, that's the deal. And, you know, at the end of it, I'm like, hey, if you have other evidence that you want to share with me, like, share it with me. I'm happy to receive it. But like, then there, you know, and I don't know, it gets messy. But I'm always happy. Like, if somebody, you know, if you want to bring evidence that goes against something that I've written or said or whatever, like, I'm happy to receive that, because what I want for all of us is the most full picture.
Yes.
History and what we're doing. And so if you shut me down because you don't agree with me for some reason, or somebody shuts you down because they're like, you're not a real scholar, you don't have the letters behind your name, whatever, you haven't had that education. It's like, well, that, you know, that how does that actually relate to, you know, the things that substantially the things that I'm saying? And if it's not, right, then, you know, yeah.
Right. It's a personal attack. It has nothing to do with what we're discussing or trying to figure out together, right?
Together, that like collaboration, you know, like, again, like, if somebody has something that they, you know, want to share or want to contradict or like whatever it is, I'm super open to hearing that. And, you know, that, but, and so it's also like sad to me when people are so like defensive or like, you know, like, no, this is my territory and I don't want to hear what you have to say. It's like, why? Like, let's learn as much as we can. Let's spread as much information as we can. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that also relieves people of the sense of entitlement and control of a narrative. So there's that, you know. Yeah. And then the, I hate to say it, but it also, you know, everybody, how can I put this? Well, I shoot from the hip. It also puts into question someone's 30, 40-year tenure track It's like, so all these years you've been telling us this, and it's really this, but it's that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm also like, if you've been saying the same thing for 30 or 40 years in your tenure track position, gosh, we're going off the rails here, you know. But I'm just like, if you're just saying the same thing, if you've been saying the same thing, and somebody else comes in and is like, hey, what about this evidence? You know, then it's like, well, you know, I as a person want to continually be learning and exploring. And like I mentioned, this new instrument that's turned up in Europe, like it could in fact change some stuff or it could not, but like we have to explore all of the venues and all of the avenues, maybe is what I was thinking, of like what's going on with that instrument. And like, maybe we won't have a conclusion. Maybe we'll just have a broader picture, but we can't just be like, oh, this doesn't look like I think it should. So therefore it's not a banjo, or this right. doesn't, you know, whatever, this doesn't conform to my idea. And therefore, you know, but it's like, you got to keep looking and you got to keep reevaluate. I mean, it's just like being a human, right? We got to keep learning. We got to keep reevaluating and thinking about the ideas that we have, the positions that we hold, and learning more. So, yeah.
So with that being said, I'm going to present to you my last official question before my unofficial question. Is there anything that you thought I would ask or wanted me to ask that I did not ask?
No. I don't think so. This has been great.
Okay.
I'm always like excited about talking to people and figuring out what they're like, what they're most interested in and what their angle is. So yeah, no.
Cool. So even though I have it here, is there anywhere else to find you besides your website and Instagram?
Those are the two good places. Those are where I hang out. Yeah.
All right. Well, I applaud you. Thank you for coming on the show. Thank you for,
thank you for having me.
I dig it. You know, thank you very much.
Yeah.
You know. And thank you for
happy to spread the banjo gospel.
Oh yeah, I got a banjo right here. I literally got an Arnold Schultz scholarship from the banjo, or was it the International Banjo
or International Bluegrass Music Association?
I should be able to say that like this because it gave me a scholarship. Forgive me.
But see, you knew Arnold Schultz's name. That's the
course, I have to. I'm in Kentucky.
Yeah, it's important.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm learning and working on some Hammerclaw, studying with Jordan Rain. You know, so yeah. And next time you come to Kentucky, let me know.
Yeah, I will, for sure. Kentucky's been a hot spot. People want to talk about the banjo in Kentucky, for sure.
Yes. I know they do.
Yeah.
So great folks. Y'all ain't got no questions because we're about to wrap up. Again, if you're just tuning in, I've been speaking with Christina Gaddy about her book, Well of Souls, Uncovering the Banjo's Hidden History. We had a great conversation about this, and I intentionally used my NPR voice. Y'all always know when you come here, you're going to learn them blues. And if you don't learn it here, find somewhere where you're going to learn it. Okay? Y'all be good.
Thank you.
Thank you.